database that keeps track of cases that are filed. In this instance, it was an unlawful detainer case, and Ms. Rousey sought to redact only her name from that online database. So I think that qualifies this case as the most modest redaction that anyone has ever sought in the case coming before this court. Other things that distinguish this case from other record-sealing cases that have been decided in the past is the fact that usually the central issue for the court to decide in a record-sealing case is the dispute, kind of the conflict between the individual's right to privacy, which is protected under the state constitution at Article 1, Section 7, and then the public's interest in transparent judicial proceedings, which is also protected under the constitution in Article 1, Section 10. What's different about this case is that here, while the redaction that Ms. Rousey seeks will promote her privacy interest, will protect her ability to obtain rental housing in the future, despite this unlawful detainer case having been filed against her. Your Honor, we submitted evidence in the trial court supporting our contention that it is a widespread practice of landlords. Your Honor, there's no finding because the trial court found that it simply didn't have the authority to order redaction in this type of case whatsoever.
What position with regard to treating evidence as facts, what position does that put us in now?
Well, I think it puts this court in the position of having to determine whether or not the trial court considered Ms. Rousey's motion under the correct legal standard, and if this court finds it did not, then the appropriate remedy is to remand to the trial court to conduct that fact-finding. And that's the remedy that we're asking for here. I think the bigger issue in the appeal is if the court does engage in that fact-finding, could the trial court possibly find that this is the type of information that GR-15 and under Walden, the GR-15 and Ishikawa cases, authorize the trial court to redact? And we think that it is.
Would it be appropriate for us to look at the declaration your client did file and pass on the question of whether or not she has demonstrated that any trier fact could find that she faces serious and imminent threat to an interest that is protected?
Your Honor, I think that because of the timing...
I think that's what one of the amicus on the other side of the ledger asked us to do.
Right, and I think, Your Honor, that because the Walden case was not decided until after Ms. Rousey had already filed her motion and after this appeal had already been filed, it simply wouldn't be procedurally fair to Ms. Rousey to require her to meet both the Ishikawa standards as well as the GR-15C standards under the circumstances. And I think that in the Walden case, the way the court dealt with the issue there was by remanding to the trial court and giving the moving party an opportunity to introduce any additional evidence that may have been needed to satisfy the more rigorous sealing requirements that Ishikawa imposes. Well, Your Honor, I think that under GR... Right. I think that under GR-15, of course, we're only required by the court rule to give notice to the other parties in the case. However, I do think that the trial court is put in the position of guarding the public's interest in this type of situation, and that the trial court could require us to give notice to additional parties if the court feels that it needs other voices to be present in order to make an informed decision as to whether the record ought to be sealed or not, such as the appellate court has done in this case by inviting other participants to weigh in on the issue. So,
would that include the screening agencies?
Certainly. I think that the trial court could invite whatever parties it thinks are appropriate that may have an interest in keeping this information in the public domain. That being said, I think that under the rationale of the Bellevue John Doe's case, that the interest of the tenant screening companies in finding out unsubstantiated unlawful detainer allegations is not a legitimate interest. And so that would be a factor that would weigh heavily against the trial court seeking input from a tenant screening company. Your Honor, the Bellevue John Doe's case actually looked closely at that issue. Of course, that was in the context of a Public Disclosure Act request. Well, Your Honor, I would actually disagree with that assertion, because if we look at the context in which the unlawful detainer allegation is made, it comes in the context of when a person is applying for rental housing. So while that allegation may not have the same kind of emotional offensive characteristics that an accusation of something like sexual misconduct would have, the specific injury that it imposes upon a rental applicant is a serious and distinct injury. It can prevent the person from obtaining housing of the person's choice.
But when you come before the court with your motion to redact, you're in essentially, at least potentially, an adversarial proceeding at which the court can find the facts and determine whether it is indeed unsubstantiated or whether it's true. Shouldn't you, in that hearing, have the burden of showing that your client actually was discriminated against on the basis of her status as a victim of domestic violence rather than for some other reason? That isn't protected.
For a number of reasons, I don't think so, Your Honor. First of all, in this particular case, that would have really required the court to find additional facts regarding the reasons the case was dismissed. The court has an interest in the efficient resolution of lawsuits. Well, I think it is. Well, Your Honor, I can answer that question in rebuttal if you'd prefer.
Or all right.
Go ahead and think about that answer.
Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court, Steve Dixon on behalf of the Washington Coalition for Open Government. And as counsel for the petitioner pointed out, the coalition is here at the invitation of the court, and we take that burden very seriously. And on behalf of the coalition, would urge you to affirm the commissioner's ruling denying Ms. Rousey's motion to redact her records. This is a case about conjecture and speculation where the law requires imminence and concreteness. This case is governed by three very, not equally important, but three factors. We have the state constitution, particularly Article 1, Section 10, which states that justice in all cases shall be administered openly. Secondly, we have Ishikawa, which the petitioner's counsel has referenced, which is a strict five-factor test, which would allow a court, a trial court level, or this court, to depart from that presumption of openness. And third, we have General Rule 15.
Well, we, in this case, have this confusing series of orders, which suggests that the commissioner did not have any particular reason and certainly wasn't applying Ishikawa. So, I mean, you want us to just affirm it, but how can we know that there was a tenable basis for the exercise of the commissioner's discretion in the face of this record, which says, no basis.
Right, no basis under the law.
It looks pretty inscrutable, you know.
No basis under the law, General 15. And to answer Your Honor's question, in Walden, this court remanded for application of GR 15 with Ishikawa. Now, a difference there is that those records were initially sealed, and they were sealed under a GR 15 standard. As this court determined in Walden, Ishikawa is a higher standard than GR 15. So the reason that case was remanded was because those records were sealed, but the court applied an improper rule. Here, if you were to remand, the commissioner found under GR 15, which is a lesser standard, there was no basis to redact. If you compound that with the Ishikawa factors, which we admit were not applied, it would be the same verdict. If there's no basis under GR 15, and GR 15 in Ishikawa is a higher standard, there is no way upon remand that the commissioner could find that there was any basis to redact the records. He'd have the same.
Denying the motion for remand. GR 15 requires him to balance to form a decision either, which suggests that we don't know what test he used, and we don't know what his decision would be if, considering the facts before him, he applied either of those tests, the Walden test or the GR 15 test.
I would submit to the court that the commissioner's ruling could have been more clear. I think the ruling does say that no basis under the law or GR 15, and I would submit to the court that the commissioner considered GR 15 and that the Ishikawa standard is a higher test that cannot be met in this case because, as Walden grafted the Ishikawa, properly grafted the Ishikawa factors onto amended GR 15, there is no basis for the commissioner to find in a higher test that the standard would be met. I think that language certainly hints that he had these things on his mind, but may not have properly considered them. We submit that his he probably is, Your Honor. I can't distinguish the language that's written in the record. However, his conclusion. I think that. In the end, his conclusion was based upon his interpretation of GR 15, as he states, no basis under the law or GR 15, and that because the Ishikawa standard is higher than that GR 15 standard, if you were to remand it and he found no interest under GR 15, if we ask him to apply a higher standard upon remand, there would not be any opportunity for him to find these interests suffice to support a motion to redact. Okay. I think the fourth Ishikawa factor says that any stakeholder should be allowed an opportunity to be heard. We believe, as you know, the voice of the citizens and the press enterprise, that we would be a stakeholder in that. I think the county, as maintaining the King County records, would be a stakeholder. I think the state, as maintaining the SCOMIS database as a whole, would be a stakeholder, and they could speak to some of the remedial measures that could be placed in a SCOMIS database to mitigate some of the damage that Ms. Rousey claims to have suffered here.
One of the things that's kind of interesting about this case is how narrow the time window is with an unlawful detainer proceeding. They come on so fast, and as one of the amicus briefs here points out, Ashley Rousey could have, theoretically, if you know, she could have gotten this settled before the lawsuit was actually filed, the unlawful detainer lawsuit. In fact, it looks like that the record suggests that the landlord filed it without having read the letter, which had explained everything and explained about the statute. One infers that the landlord was unaware of the statutory protection afforded to victims of domestic violence, and as soon as that was explained, this is what it looks like anyway. I grant there's no facts found, but it withdrew. And so if only, you know, the letter had arrived a day earlier, this wouldn't have come up at all. There wouldn't have been any way for the public or for the information to even get on SCOMIS. Isn't that a factor that can be weighed in this kind of case?
I think if I understand you correctly, yes. And I apologize, I can't speak as to why Indigo is not here today. But the Landlord Association filed a brief, and I think the law against discrimination, which is cited in our brief 59, RCW 59-18-580, says that landlords cannot discriminate on the basis of domestic violence status.
I mean, so that really makes this case a lot different from one where somebody doesn't pay the rent, right?
I
mean, there's a protection. This is an interest. I mean, I don't know why a court cannot say that this is a compelling interest, or whatever the phraseology is in the Ishikawa standard.
I absolutely agree with you. She has identified a compelling interest. However, it's a two-part test under the first Ishikawa factor, and the first part is that there is an imminent threat. And I would submit to you, Your Honors, that this unlawful detainer action was filed in March of 2008. We're now July of 2009, and there is no record before the court that Ms. Rousey has been forced to leave her original apartment, that she's applied for another...
time when this matter was before the commissioner, and we know nothing about what has happened after the motion for reconsideration was entered.
And it is not, it is...
help us very much to say we don't know that Ms. Rousey has had nothing bad happen to her since. We don't know one way or another.
Right, but it's Ms. Rousey's burden to show that there is an imminent threat.
Well, but, I mean, what authority is there? It doesn't seem to me that there, I can't think of a case where when what we're looking at is a threat is that you wait until somebody gets hurt and then say in retrospect, yeah, that was a threat. You know, ordinarily when the law penalizes making a threat, it's in order to prevent future harm from being carried out. And there would seem to be quite a bit of documentation here that, you know, if you're a renter and this information gets onto SCOMUS, that the consequences are fairly predictable.
And we submit that there is not any proof of an imminent threat here. There is. It requires the court to make several leaps. Ms. Rousey would have to decide she wants to move.
Well, but before she does all of that, what would she have to prove, assuming that you don't have to go through the whole process of having something bad happen to you before you can say there was a threat? What more would she have to show, in your view, than what is in the record to prove that it was an imminent?
I think you would have to have some type of either prior examples in King County, maybe not Ms. Rousey, but prior examples where someone has been denied housing based upon an unlawful detainer finding. That no longer
is it. In the criminal law, when somebody makes a threat to kill, we don't say, well, we're not going to take that seriously unless you can show he's actually killed somebody before.
Absolutely. And I don't think that there is no landlord is threatening to deny housing. They've submitted application.
In the civil rights area, we don't require that the plaintiff have proof of the intent. We only...
I think it would. I would point the court to two cases where they have found an imminent threat, and that would be in Ishikawa itself, for example, where there was a criminal case where there could be damage to an ongoing investigation or release. That's the standard that's flowed from Ishikawa. For a civil context, I'd point the court to the case of In Re R.E., the marriage of R.E., where there were mental health records at stake, and there were therapists that testified, if these records are made public, which was the motion, there will be damage to the person. This was one person, if the records are released, a minor child, if the records are released, there would be damage.
Thank you. You have used your time, and thank you. The court appreciates your willingness to participate.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to return to the question I was asked right before my time expired the first time around, which is whether we're asking for the court to impose a sort of a broad per se rule that any time allegations in a lawsuit are unsubstantiated, meaning not proven in the case, that information would then be sealed. That is certainly not what we're asking for. We don't think that the law supports that. But we do think that in any case where the information that's asking that the person's asking to be sealed is related to an unsubstantiated allegation, that would be one factor that the court would weigh in deciding whether to go ahead and seal that record or not. And I think that the court rule GR15C, as well as the Ishikawa case itself, establish a clear check requiring the trial court to actually conduct a hearing and make detailed factual findings whenever it enters into an order sealing or redacting court records, and do so on a case-by-case basis. I think that adequately protects against any sort of blanket sealing policy. Now, I want to go back to the fact that under Article 1, Section 10, the purpose of that constitutional provision, as it's been interpreted, is to enable the public to serve as kind of a watchdog to make sure that the courts are functioning in a fair and appropriate manner, and assist the public in monitoring the performance of its judges and so forth, especially in a state where judges are elected. Well, the information that Ms. Rousey is seeking to redact is not going to be used for any sort of public purpose consistent with Article 1, Section 10. It's going to be used as an implement for tenant screening, That's the only reason that Ms. Rousey seeks to have it taken out of the SCOMIS index.
Well, ordinarily, you know, when it comes to open records and things of that nature, it seems like the law generally does not inquire into why somebody wants to know. We don't ask members of the press why they want to know. We don't ask people who make public disclosure inquiries, why do you want to have that?
Well, Your Honor, I do think...
The rule is the records are public, period.
Well, Your Honor, I do think that under the cases...
In our legislature, in the Rozier case, our Supreme Court suggested who was asking for the records might have something to do with whether...
But, Your Honor, what I'm referring to is the language in the cases of Roofer v. Abbott Labs and Dreiling v. Jane, where the state Supreme Court held that information that's submitted in anticipation of a judicial decision and that enters into the court's decision-making process is the information that receives the core protection under Article 1, Section 10, not information that's extraneous. Well, I think that it goes back to this conundrum of where the allegations are unsubstantiated, such as you have in Bellevue John Doe's. In that case, the mere allegations themselves were not taken as substantiation. In this case, the complaint was not a sworn, verified complaint. It was signed onto by counsel. So I think those are relevant factors. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes the